One was acquitted, and a third was allowed to plead nolo contendere to a minor charge. One might think the Phoenix City assassination would have caused the Eisenhower-Nixon administration to declare war on organized crime. But it didn't. J. Edgar Hoover continued to turn a blind eye toward the mafia in general, and Marcello in particular. Time magazine, in 1975, first revealed secret meetings and friendship between Hoover and mob boss Frank Costello, which were confirmed by William Hundley, the Justice Department organized crime chief during the Kennedy administration. Hoover's predilection for gambling on horse races is now well known, and it's also possible Hoover was blackmailed by the mafia over his closeted homosexuality. Carlos Marcello's partners had gotten away with murder, but they had lost the lucrative cash cow that was Phoenix City. However, they learned from their mistakes, and the next time Marcello's associates assassinated a government official, a patsy would be on hand to be quickly blamed and killed to divert suspicion from organized crime. In addition to Trafficante, another important mob figure with whom Carlos Marcello became involved in the 1950s was Johnny Rosselli, the mafia don who handled the Chicago mob's interests in Los Angeles and Las Vegas. Rosselli was a smooth operator who, in the 1940s, had hobnobbed with movie studio chiefs until he was caught running a union shakedown operation for the mob. After Rosselli's release from federal prison, he still had clout in Las Vegas, but the studio heads had to distance themselves from him. Court records show Rosselli was still influential enough to be an executive producer on three low-budget film noirs in the late 1940s, though his name couldn't be listed in the credits. One of the films, He Walked by Night, featured a crazed ex-serviceman who turned killer. The young ex-serviceman kept his long-barreled weapon hidden away, wrapped in a blanket, but he carried a pistol and used it to shoot a policeman in his patrol car. Rosselli later credibly confessed his role in JFK's murder, which had a similar scenario involving Lee Oswald and Officer Tippit. Before leaving the movie business for the greener pastures of Las Vegas and Cuban casinos, Rosselli helped get his friend Frank Sinatra a dramatic role in From Here to Eternity, which reignited Sinatra's career. Rosselli's biographers say the pressure he applied on Sinatra's behalf inspired the famous horse's head in the bed scene in the first Godfather novel and film. Johnny Rosselli was very active in Guatemala in the mid-1950s, and his biographers documented from two sources that Rosselli's primary concern in Guatemala was to protect and advance the interests of a New Orleans company with ties to Carlos Marcello. In 1956, Marcello decided that Guatemala would be the most appropriate country from which to obtain a fake birth certificate, since it was easily accessible to New Orleans by air, telephone, and telegraph. President Castillo Armas ruled the country, having been installed as dictator after the Eisenhower-Nixon administration used the CIA to overthrow the liberal government of the democratically elected Jacopo Arbenz in 1954. While President Armas reportedly did not take bribes from the mafia, that was not true of his prime minister. Carlos Marcello paid $100,000 to Guatemala's prime minister and his former law partner for his fake birth certification and citizenship papers. There was also casino gambling in Guatemala, run by Ted Lewin, Johnny Rosselli's associate from Los Angeles. President Armas tried to close the casinos, and he jailed Rosselli's friend Lewin. 4 days later, in July 1957, Armas was assassinated, apparently by a lone communist assassin. The assassin was said by accounts to have immediately committed suicide with the same rifle he had used to kill the president. One historian notes that, even more conveniently, police produced some leftist propaganda that had supposedly been found in his pockets and a suspicious diary, but few, if any, Guatemalans believed the official explanation. Rosselli's biographer said a more plausible explanation, one that gained currency in Guatemala City at the time of the shooting, was that Castillo Armas had run afoul of the mafia. There are striking parallels between the 1957 Guatemalan patsy Vasquez Sanchez and Lee Oswald, the seemingly communist former Marine who was able to get a job at the sensitive Dallas U-2 map firm at the height of the Cuban Missile Crisis, even though he had recently returned from the Soviet Union. In Guatemala, the government described the patsy as a communist fanatic, expelled from the Guatemalan army 6 months ago for communist ideology, but he had been allowed to join the presidential palace guard. Like Oswald, the Guatemalan patsy was supposedly an ardent communist, yet no evidence ever turned up that he was a member of the Communist Party. The U.S. government and news media, still in the thrall of the McCarthy-Nixon Red Scare, which saw hundreds blacklisted or graylisted in Hollywood and elsewhere, quickly accepted that a seemingly lone communist had murdered President Armas. Eisenhower's son John declared that the accused killer had been acting under orders from Moscow. However, historians point out that a letter supposedly found on the patsy's body, said by authorities to be the bodyguard's correspondence with Moscow about his assassination assignment, was actually only a form letter postcard from Radio Moscow. Another U.S.-backed right-wing dictator quickly took Armas's place, and Marcello kept his fake citizenship papers. At the time of the assassination, Marcello was involved in a business venture with Rosselli in Las Vegas, the Godfather's only direct foray into that city. Rosselli helped Marcello become a partner in the new Las Vegas Tropicana Hotel and Casino, then the most luxurious on the Strip. Vegas needed that luxury to compete with the burgeoning mafia casinos being built in Havana. Rosselli was only a mafia don, not a mob boss or godfather like Marcello, but he was the consummate dealmaker, and he managed the Tropicana for a time. However, Rosselli and the mafia were still learning how to hide mob ownership from the Nevada Gaming Commission. As Marcello later explained to Jack Van Lanningham, he tried to get into gambling in Vegas using a frontman, and all was going good until the Nevada Gaming Commission learned that Carlos Marcello was involved. They were shut down and lost a great deal of money in the venture, and he stayed clear of Vegas after that. Marcello always tried to stay out of the limelight and the newspapers, and he could have all the gambling he wanted in Louisiana without worrying about a state gaming commission. Marcello stayed out of Las Vegas after that, even in the 1970s, when he had a chance to put up money for the real casino depicted in Martin Scorsese's film, Casino. Instead, Marcello simply brokered that deal to the Kansas City mob, getting an enormous one-time and untraceable finder's fee in the process, something the FBI learned but never revealed to the public. Even after the Tropicana problem, Marcello continued to deal with the smooth, articulate Rosselli. In addition to Sinatra, Rosselli was close to Dean Martin, Marilyn Monroe, and other celebrities. Furthermore, like Marcello, Rosselli wasn't an American citizen, having been born Filippo Sacco in Hesperia, Italy, on July 4, 1905. But unlike with Marcello, the U.S. government didn't realize Rosselli wasn't a citizen, and it wouldn't learn that until 1966, setting off a chain of events that would help trigger Watergate and lead to Rosselli's gruesome 1976 murder on Trafficante's orders, with Marcello's support. But in 1957, the 52-year-old Rosselli and the 47-year-old Marcelli still got along well. Marcello and Rosselli had something else in common. Neither hesitated to kill those who got in his way or who incurred his wrath. By the mid-1950s, Willie Bioff, the key witness whose testimony had sent Rosselli to prison and ended his glamorous Hollywood lifestyle, was living in Phoenix and was good friends with Arizona Senator Barry Goldwater. Despite Bioff's friendship with and political support of Senator Goldwater, Rosselli and the mafia got their revenge. Bioff was killed when his truck exploded in his driveway at his Phoenix home on November 4, 1955, destroyed by a dynamite bomb. No one was arrested for the murder. 3 years later, Rosselli approved the murder of another good friend of Goldwater's, Gus Greenbaum, owner of the Riviera Casino and mayor of the Las Vegas Strip. After becoming addicted to heroin, Greenbaum refused mob orders to sell his interest in the Riviera. So on December 3, 1958, Greenbaum was almost completely decapitated, while his wife, Bess, had her throat slashed with a butcher knife, according to crime writer Ovid Damaris. Senator Goldwater attended Greenbaum's funeral, but there was no arrest. Several years later, Damaris documented the arrival of two hitmen from Miami shortly before the murder. Afterward, they left in a private plane. Roselli may well have used his mutual associate with Marcello, Santo Traficante, to provide the hitmen. Employing out-of-town hitmen was a technique both Traficante and Marcello increasingly used, since it was difficult to tie them to a crime and locale. 5 years later, all three men would employ a variation of that approach against JFK. Carlos Marcello's empire continued to grow and would soon be bringing in $2 billion annually from criminal operations in Louisiana, Mississippi, and Texas, according to his biographer. While much of that went to payoffs and support for a wide range of local, county, state, and federal officials, Marcello had plenty of cash to invest in land and in legitimate businesses, to which he later boasted to Van Lanningham he gave a criminal competitive advantage. Not that Marcello necessarily bought those legitimate businesses. As Marcello later explained to Jack Van Lanningham, he took what he wanted by force. Anyone that got in the way of what he wanted was eliminated, one way or another. He told me about the bars and liquor business in New Orleans. He never bought bars, he took them. Marcello would send men to see the owner that he wanted to do business with. The owner was told that, from now on, you will be selling our liquor. If the bar owner made trouble or refused, fights were staged, furniture broken up, and the guests harassed. Whores were sent in to cause trouble. The owner of the bar either went out of business or went into partnership with Marcello. Marcello had his own still in New Orleans and also shipped liquor in from Texas in 5-gallon cans. Since all of the police were on the payroll, it did no good to call them. He had them all in his pocket, along with the judges. That pattern was repeated dozens, probably hundreds of times. And not just in the bar and restaurant business, but also in the companies that supplied them. Marcello also explained to Van Lanningham that the way to make and keep money was to buy ground, in other words, land. Marcello told Van Lanningham that he owned hundreds of acres of ground that he had bought for peanuts, and now it was worth millions. Marcello's real estate holdings in Louisiana and cities such as Dallas were extensive and growing. They included his secluded and massive 6,400-acre Churchill Farms estate. Once mostly swamp, part of the land had been drained, and Marcello used the remote farmhouse in the middle of it for some of his most sensitive meetings, including several concerning plans for JFK's assassination. By 1957, Marcello had set up his daily office at the nondescript Town and Country Motel, a location he would use for routine businesses for the next 2.5 decades. Located on the equally nondescript airline highway connecting the city to Moisant Airport, it was an appropriate venue for the publicity-shy godfather. The road was described by his biographer as an ugly, endless procession of gas stations, parking lots, billboards, striptease joints, sleazy bars, cheap motels, and neon signs. The kind of area that could be found in most larger cities throughout America at that time. The Town and Country Motel was the center of a multi-state prostitution ring as well as the center of Marcello's gambling empire, which included his National Racing Wire network. Every Sunday, Marcello held court in the motel restaurant. Marcello's private office behind the motel was the site of most of his weekday meetings when he wasn't traveling through his extensive empire, where he also maintained smaller offices and mistresses. Marcello's main office had one other notable feature, a sign on the door leading out that, according to his biographer, gave visitors a chilling reminder of whom they were dealing with. Three can keep a secret if two are dead. When frustrated New Orleans citizens tried to bring in experienced law enforcement help from the outside, even there they were thwarted. The former FBI agent in charge of Chicago, Guy Bannister, was brought in to be New Orleans' assistant police superintendent, focusing on the ties between organized crime and the department. However, the extremely conservative and racist Bannister seemed more interested in going after left-wingers and alleged communists. He quit the force after pulling his gun on a waiter in a bar. The alcoholic Bannister then formed a local private detective agency. By the early 1960s, his clients included Carlos Marcello, who would use Bannister's law enforcement connections, his interest in white supremacy, and his undercover anti-communist activities in the plot to kill JFK. Carlos Marcello was free to expand his criminal empire, using murders when needed, and according to the New Orleans Crime Commission, those included the gangland-style killing of two of Marcello's narcotics associates, according to John H. Davis. The heroin network Marcello shared with Traficante was their most lucrative, most secret, and thus most deadly enterprise. Marcello continued to rely on his own brothers and extended family, when possible. Of his six brothers, the youngest, Joe, was his favorite and most trusted, acting as Carlos's right-hand man and immediate underboss. But each of the others, Pete, Pascal, Vincent, Tony, and Sammy, also played key roles in helping manage Marcello's ever-expanding empire. There appeared to be no concerns for Carlos Marcello on the federal front, since Richard Nixon enjoyed increasing power and respect as the 1950s advanced, due to a series of health issues plaguing President Eisenhower. Nixon had weathered the only two potential scandals he'd recently faced, aided in one case by his longtime patron, billionaire Howard Hughes. The other scandal involved exposure of the mob ties of attorney Murray Schottner, Nixon's closest advisor. Richard Nixon and Murray Schottner had long-time and well-documented links to the mafia. Los Angeles mobster Mickey Cohen admitted giving Nixon $5,000, nearly $50,000 in today's money, in Nixon's first race for Congress in California in 1946. Cohen upped that to almost $75,000, almost $700,000 today, for Nixon's 1950 Senate run. Schottner, Nixon's chief political aide and strategist from 1946 until the time of Watergate, had arranged those payoffs. Schottner, an attorney and his brother, had represented 221 of Cohen's bookmakers in just 1 4-year period. Schottner wasn't the only Nixon associate tied to the mafia. Richard Nixon's best friend from the 1950s until his death, Charles Bibi Rebozo, had extensive banking, real estate, and business ties to the mob, including associates of Meyer Lansky and Santo Traficante. Evidence, including later admissions by former government officials such as John Mitchell, shows that Rebozo often fronted businesses and shady deals for Nixon in locales ranging from Cuba to Florida, to the Bahamas. However, Schottner's role as an advisor to Vice President Nixon had caught the eye of Democrats in Congress. As it happened, a congressional committee probing Schottner publicized the case before having enough evidence against him, and Schottner avoided any charges. He did have to assume a less prominent role for the Vice President, away from the public eye, but Nixon's other mafia ties remained unexposed. One of the counsels on the committee investigating Schottner was a young Robert F. Kennedy, and he learned from the mistakes he saw in that investigation. In 1957, Robert Kennedy teamed up with his brother, Senator John F. Kennedy from Massachusetts. They were investigating Teamster corruption, starting with Union President Dave Beck, the only major union leader to support the generally anti-union Eisenhower-Nixon ticket. After corruption charges forced Beck to step down, John and Robert Kennedy focused on his successor, Jimmy Hoffa. The Kennedys' investigation of Hoffa would have crucial ramifications for all concerned. The corruption and mafia ties the brothers uncovered would lead them to focus on exposing Hoffa's crimes, first through congressional hearings and later through prosecutions that would eventually send Hoffa to prison. Their actions began a blood feud between the Kennedys and Hoffa that would last until JFK's assassination, followed 5 years later by Roberts. Finally, The mafia ties uncovered in 1957 by the Kennedy brothers' Hoffa investigation soon led them to focus extensively on fighting organized crime. Some say that effort was a way for the politically ambitious John to counter rumors about his own immensely wealthy father's ties to or friendship with members of organized crime. Others claim that JFK pursued the mob to garner publicity, and it is true that he generated huge amounts of media coverage for the anti-mafia hearings he pushed. But from newspaper headlines alone, there was clearly a need for someone to take on the mafia in America, since J. Edgar Hoover and the Eisenhower-Nixon administration seemed so reluctant to do so. Starting in the late 1950s, John F. Kennedy took up that fight. The Kennedys wasted no time in going after Carlos Marcello and Santo Traficante, both soon to be close allies with the new Teamster leader, Jimmy Hoffa. Senator Kennedy dispatched a trusted investigator, former journalist Pierre Salinger, to New Orleans to look into Marcello's criminal activities firsthand. Before his death, Salinger spoke to me about that and described the fear and intimidation he encountered in New Orleans in the late 1950s. While Salinger could document a clear paper trail, people at all levels were afraid to talk. He himself worried that he wouldn't survive the experience. However, aided by the New Orleans Crime Commission, a group of concerned local citizens headed by Aaron Cohn, Salinger helped the Kennedys put together a remarkable list of Marcello's criminal enterprises. The Kennedys knew one thing Marcello feared was publicity, so they arranged to force him to come to Washington to testify before the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management, chaired by Arkansas Senator John McClellan. However, the Kennedys were its driving force, and they received the lion's share of the enormous radio, newspaper, and television publicity the hearings generated. The Kennedys and Salinger knew that Marcello would simply take the fifth, so they devised a strategy designed to convey Marcello's story to the American people anyway. First, they extensively questioned Aaron Cohn of the Crime Commission, whose answers gave a detailed overview of Marcello's life and numerous crimes. Next, they questioned Salinger, who provided more documentation and details about the complex web of companies controlled by Marcello. Finally, on March 24, 1959, Carlos Marcello himself was forced to go before the glare of television lights in Washington to confront the Kennedys' Senate committee. Chapter 5. Marcello, Cuba, and Jack Ruby. Robert F. Kennedy personally confronted Godfather Carlos Marcello for the first and only time on Tuesday, March 24, 1959, in a Senate hearing room on Capitol Hill. RFK was the brash, blunt-spoken chief counsel of the Senate Select Committee on Improper Activities in Labor and Management, which now focused on organized crime. But he still maintained what was often described as a boyish demeanor, and that was especially true when compared with his older brother, Senator John F. Kennedy. However, on that day, both JFK and Senator Barry Goldwater had other business to attend to, and were not at the hearing. That left RFK in full command of the interrogation of Carlos Marcello, the first of a series of events involving the Godfather that would result in tragedy for RFK, his brother, and at times, even Marcello. Attired in a well-tailored, expensive-looking pinstriped suit, the 49-year-old Godfather sat at the witness table. Dark glasses concealed his eyes, and he would wear them for the entire hearing. Though Marcello tried to maintain a relaxed image in his rare public appearances, he could be quick to anger. Perhaps the dark glasses were intended to make it harder for RFK and the senators to read his reactions. Seated beside Marcello was his top Washington attorney, Jack Wasserman, one of the country's best immigration attorneys. The fact that he chose Wasserman instead of a criminal defense attorney or a high-profile Washington power attorney showed that what Marcello feared most was his lack of citizenship. Unlike Santo Traficante, Marcello couldn't duck the Kennedys' subpoena by traveling to another country. As a non-citizen, if Marcello ever left the United States, he might be denied re-entry, So Wasserman told him he had no other recourse than to report for the hearing. With his bow tie and glasses, Wasserman looked nothing like a typical mob lawyer, and more like a university professor. Next to Wasserman was one of the Godfather's brothers, Vincent Marcello, who ran the slot machines for his brother's empire. In contrast to his compact, portly brother, Vincent was taller and more conventionally handsome. He looked like a well-dressed businessman, not a mafia underboss. Still, with his Roman profile and imperious attitude, Carlos Marcello was a commanding presence in the hearing room. But Robert Kennedy, who had already sparred with Jimmy Hoffa in earlier hearings, remained focused on his carefully prepared questions, designed to reveal to the American public the huge scope of Marcello's criminal empire. Part of that involved exposing Marcello's control of Dallas and important parts of the heroin trade. When RFK asked Marcello, "You are an associate of Joseph Civello of Dallas, Texas, who attended the meeting in Apalachin?" Marcello replied, "I decline to answer on the ground it may tend to incriminate me." A later Senate report would make it clear that Joe Civello controls all rackets in Dallas and vicinity. Along with another Dallas Marcello underboss, restaurateur Joe Campisi Sr., Civello conveyed Marcello's orders to lower-level mobsters in Dallas, such as Jack Ruby. RFK then asked if Marcello was an associate of Sam Carolla, who was deported in 1947 as a narcotics trafficker. Marcello said only, "I decline to answer on the same ground." However, other witnesses and huge charts clearly showed the importance of Marcello and New Orleans to what would soon become known as the French Connection narcotics trade. RFK then asked, "Have you been able to use law enforcement officials to assist you in your business, Mr. Marcello?" Once again, Marcello fell back on his right to avoid incriminating himself, as he would for almost all the questions that day. Still, by the time RFK had finished his list of questions, they, along with information provided earlier by Assistant Counsel Pierre Salinger and Aaron Cohn of the New Orleans Crime Commission, had given the American press and public their first good overview of Marcello's criminal empire. Gambling, prostitution, corruption of public officials, real estate fraud, terrorizing legitimate businessmen, narcotics trafficking, and much more. Then came the time for the senators to ask their questions. Since RFK had said that Mr. Carlos Marcello has been under orders of deportation from the United States since about 1953, much of their questioning centered on why he was still allowed to live in the United States. Cohn had earlier testified that Marcello had been in court some 37 times in various appellate proceedings and in various hearings to avoid deportation, but it's clear that some senators felt some factor other than Jack Wasserman's legal skill accounted for the current administration's failure to deport Marcello. Senator Sam Ervin of North Carolina, later chairman of the famed Senate Watergate Committee, began by reminding Marcello of his two felony convictions and then asked how a man with that kind of record can stay in the United States for 5 years, 9 months, 24 days after he is found to be an undesirable alien. How have you managed to stay here? Marcello eventually answered, "I wouldn't know." Senator Ervin expressed his frustration at the current Eisenhower-Nixon administration, saying, "The American people are entitled to more protection at the hands of the law than to have an undesirable alien who has committed serious felonies remain in this country." He summed up by essentially calling Marcello a leech who preyed upon law-abiding people and who ought to be removed from this country. South Dakota's Senator Carl Mundt took up the cudgel against Marcello and the Eisenhower-Nixon administration, commenting that Committee Chairman Senator John McClellan should direct a letter to the Attorney General inquiring as to why this deportation has not been implemented. Even so, Marcello left the hearing unbowed, and despite all the publicity, as long as President Dwight Eisenhower and Vice President Nixon remained in office, no serious additional efforts were made to deport the Godfather. However, John and Robert Kennedy weren't through with the mafia, and Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana was set to receive the same treatment accorded Marcello. Giancana was a former mob hitman, both ruthless and charming. He would soon be involved in a well-publicized romance with Phyllis McGuire, one of America's most popular singers at the time. He wasn't a godfather like Marcello, but essentially ran the day-to-day operations of the Chicago mob for two elder mafia chiefs. Giancana's influence extended beyond Chicago to Las Vegas, Hollywood, and Reno, with the help of his mafia don, Johnny Rosselli. On June 9, 1959, RFK verbally sparred with Sam Giancana, trying to draw him into a revealing response. RFK asked, "Would you tell us, if you have opposition from anybody, that you dispose of them by having them stuffed in a trunk? Is that what you do, Mr. Giancana?" Giancana appeared to stifle a laugh, not taking the committee and RFK's questions seriously, leading RFK to ask, "Is there something funny about it, Mr. Giancana? And would you tell us anything about any of your operations, or will you just giggle every time I ask you a question? I thought only little girls giggled, Mr. Giancana." RFK was unable to prod Giancana to do more than plead the fifth, which Giancana did over 36 times. Nevertheless, as with Marcello, RFK was still able to expose Giancana's criminal network, which included narcotics trafficking, something the Chicago Mafia for years disingenuously continued to claim it avoided. RFK also relied on questioning Pierre Salinger before the committee to put even more of Giancana's crimes on the record. As they sought to question additional mob leaders, Senator Kennedy and RFK were stymied on one occasion by the CIA, foreshadowing problems with the agency that would plague the two men even after JFK became president. In a 1975 report for the New York Times, that was confirmed by two RFK aides. Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Seymour Hersh discovered that in 1959 the CIA had given a free pass to one mob boss for his help in trying to assassinate Fidel Castro for the U.S. government. When RFK and his aides tried to question him in private, the mafia chief replied, "You can't touch me. I've got immunity." Robert demanded to know, "Who gave you immunity?" The mafia boss replied, "The CIA. I'm working for them, but I can't talk about it. Top secret." RFK must have been stunned, but after looking into it, he found that the CIA had made a deal with the mob boss. As eventually documented in the 1970s by Hoffa expert Dan Moldea, in 1959 the CIA was working with three mob bosses from the northeastern United States trying to assassinate Fidel. Those mob bosses, James Plumeri, Russell Bufalino, and Salvatore Granello, were contacted and handled by Teamster President Jimmy Hoffa, who acted as a cutout for the CIA in the transaction. Hoffa was a logical choice because both knew Cuban President Fidel Castro and the mafia viewed him as an ally. Before Castro and his allies assumed power on January 1, 1959, Hoffa had been involved in CIA-sanctioned arms smuggling to Cuba. By the early summer of 1959, Hoffa was participating in a complex deal, one that John and Robert Kennedy tried to unravel using their hearings and investigators. In the deal, Hoffa's mob associates sold surplus planes to Cuba, financed by Teamster money, and it also involved stolen securities. The Kennedys' investigation hit a stone wall because they couldn't locate a mysterious Jack LaRue, apparently the alias of a Hoffa associate involved in the deal. Hoffa's complicated transaction was also likely used to provide cover for his work on the 1959 CIA mafia plots to kill Fidel. Those Hoffa-brokered plots would last for almost a year, but because the northeastern mobsters didn't have extensive resources in Castro's Cuba, their assassination plans made little progress. As part of their hearings, John and Robert Kennedy wanted to question Godfather Santo Traficante about the murder of Albert Anastasia. Though Traficante fled to Cuba to avoid testifying, In his place, the Kennedys heard testimony from the Miami Crime Commission chief. Under questioning from RFK, he talked about Traficante's heroin network and his mob's 21 gang killings in 20 years, none of which were ever solved. To show he wasn't afraid of the Kennedys or the committee, Traficante had ordered another mob hit the previous day, and Robert had to announce in the hearing that he had been informed there was another one yesterday. Like the others, it would never be solved. On June 9, 1959, Fidel ordered that Traficante be placed in a comfortable detention center in Havana, along with several of his mob associates. Historians still debate the reasons for Traficante's detention, some saying the Godfather wanted to be detained in Cuba so he wouldn't have to return to the United States to testify about the Anastasia killing to the Kennedys or to New York City authorities. Traficante's confinement was comfortable, and he was even allowed to attend his daughter's lavish wedding at the Habana Hilton. One account says that once the Godfather was released, Traficante continued to visit Havana for almost 3 months. However, other historians cite Traficante's later testimony and information from some of his associates to the effect that his detention wasn't voluntary and that, at times, he feared for his life. Given these conflicting views, it's probable that his detention was initially unexpected and potentially dangerous. But as time went by, a financial accommodation was gradually reached, leading to his release. His stay in Cuba lasted until the Kennedys' committee had finished its work. When Traficante was in detention, it was hard for him to access his considerable wealth, and he had no easy way to communicate with his most powerful ally, Carlos Marcello. The only way to get Marcello's help was to use trusted messengers who could freely travel from the United States to Cuba and back without arousing the suspicion of U.S. or Cuban authorities. In Marcello's organization, there was a man well-suited for the role of messenger and courier between the two godfathers, Jack Ruby. Ruby's role was confirmed by a British man named John Wilson Hudson, who was detained with Traficante. Unlike most of the others in detention, Hudson did not have a criminal record. Hudson caused a stir after the Kennedy assassination when he told authorities that in detention in 1959, he had met a man who accompanied the person who brought Traficante his meals. Hudson said the man visited the detained Traficante frequently, and that man was Jack Ruby. To understand how Ruby came to be a messenger between Marcello and Traficante in 1959, and how he came to play a critical role for both men in their 1963 murder of JFK, it's important to look closely at his background. Knowing who Jack Ruby really was, and the role he played in organized crime for decades, is crucial to understanding JFK's assassination, since Ruby's actions before, during, and after the tragedy were dictated by the Mafia. Originally born Jack Rubenstein in Chicago on March 25, 1911, Jack Ruby dropped out of high school and began working for the mob. According to Seth Cantor, the respected journalist who saw Ruby at Parkland Hospital soon after JFK was shot, the young Ruby delivered sealed envelopes at the rate of $1 per errand for Chicago's number one racketeer, Al Capone. Investigator Scott Malone says that Ruby moved from Chicago to Los Angeles in 1933 and began selling handicappers' tip sheets at Santa Anita Racetrack. Johnny Rosselli testified to the Kefauver Crime Committee in 1951 that he, too, had moved from Chicago to Los Angeles in 1933 to oversee gambling at Santa Anita for the Chicago mob. By 1939, Ruby was back in Chicago as a secretary to the Waste Handlers Union and was questioned in connection with the murder of the secretary-treasurer of the local. Even though the victim was Ruby's friend, he gave no useful information to the police, showing those in power that he could be trusted not to talk. The union was described by the FBI as largely a shakedown operation. Malone points out that murder enabled the mob and eventually the Teamsters to take over the union. Years later, Robert Kennedy wrote that this murder was important in helping the mafia eventually dominate the Teamsters. Lewis Kuttner, a Chicago lawyer and staff attorney for the Kefauver Committee, says that Ruby hobnobbed with Chicago mob boss Sam Giancana and his crowd during this period. According to Michael Valentine, author of two recent histories of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, FBN, some members of the Ruby family had a long history in the illicit drug trade. One of Jack Ruby's brothers was convicted in 1939 of buying 2 ounces of heroin. One high FBI official wrote that one of Ruby's brothers had been his informant since July 1946. Ruby would soon also become involved in the narcotics trade. In 1947, Ruby worked in the Chicago Mafia's attempt to move into Dallas, according to former Dallas Sheriff Steve Guthrie. That was at a time when Marcello was just taking over control of the New Orleans Mafia. After Marcello was in firm control of the rackets in Dallas, Ruby began to perform work for his organization. The Jewish Jack Ruby could never aspire to the heights of non-Sicilian mob heavyweights like Meyer Lansky or Mickey Cohen, so the low-level mobster basically had to scramble to do whatever he could for the local mob powers. In 1950, Jack Ruby briefed the Kefauver Committee about organized crime in Chicago, according to Louis Kuttner. In addition, Kuttner's staff learned that Ruby was a syndicate lieutenant who had been sent to Dallas to serve as a liaison for Chicago mobsters. This was the first of many times Ruby would appear to cooperate with authorities in return for protecting his and his superiors' criminal activities, or to find out what authorities knew. FBN agent Jack Cusack had informed the McClellan Committee in January 1958 that mafioso Joseph Civello ran the heroin business in Dallas, and Cusack linked Civello with Marcello, Traficante, and Jimmy Hoffa, according to Valentine. Mafia expert David E. Scheim wrote that later Civello informed the FBI that he had known Ruby casually for about 10 years. An employee of Civello's told the FBI that Ruby was a frequent visitor and associate of Civello. Investigative journalist Ovid Damaris reported that Civello told him, "Yeah, I knew Jack. We were friends, and I used to go to his club." Civello, as noted earlier, was Carlos Marcello's top underboss in Dallas. Jack Ruby's close relationship to law enforcement, a major factor in the aftermath of JFK's assassination, began to develop in the 1950s. It continued to grow into the early 1960s when, according to one Warren Commission file, Ruby was well acquainted with virtually every officer of the Dallas police force. Another Warren Commission document called Ruby the payoff man for the Dallas Police Department. If Ruby was the payoff man, then who was he working for? After all, Ruby was just a small-time hood. It's clear now, and confirmed by Carlos Marcello's own comments about Ruby during Camtex, that Ruby was Marcello's payoff man for the Dallas police. The police corruption wasn't just about money, since Ruby was soon involved in various nightclubs and with strippers and prostitutes. It was said that policemen never had to pay for a drink at Ruby's club, and sometimes were even provided with women. Ruby was very close friends with Dallas Police Captain Will Fritz, who headed the Homicide Bureau. According to the attorney for Officer J.D. Tippett, Ruby, in spite of his reputation of being a hood, was allowed complete run of the Homicide Bureau. Ruby would later take advantage of that access to kill Oswald. But Ruby had even higher friends on the Dallas police force, and an FBI document says that Ruby took the chief of police of Dallas to Hot Springs, Arkansas in 1956 when it was a gambling mecca. Jack Ruby took advantage of his law enforcement ties whenever he could. Rosselli's biographers documented that from 1947 to 1963, Jack Ruby was arrested 9 times in 16 years, but developed connections to the Dallas police strong enough that he never faced a trial. According to one Warren Commission document, Ruby was active in the Dallas segment of Traficante and Marcello's French Connection heroin network. the same network that John and Robert Kennedy investigated in their 1959 hearings. The document said that in 1956, Jack Ruby of Dallas gave the okay to operate locally for a large narcotics setup operating between Mexico, Texas, and the East. Ruby appears to have had a small role in making sure Marcello's heroin that flowed through Dallas from Mexico and the Texas ports stayed en route to Chicago. Declassified files show that that same heroin network would play a role in JFK's murder. One female heroin courier who worked for Ruby tried to expose the plot to assassinate JFK just prior to his murder. A major French heroin trafficker, Michel Victor Meretz, would be in Dallas when JFK was shot. Meretz's associate, French-Canadian heroin kingpin Lucien Rivard, was imprisoned with Traficante in Havana in 1959. Congressional investigator Michael Ewing wrote that Ruby had several dozen friends, employers, associates, and acquaintances who were significantly involved in organized crime. He also noted Ruby's close friendship with the head of the Special Dallas Police Unit, charged with investigating organized crime cases, as well as narcotics and vice, whom Warren Commission testimony shows regularly, sometimes nightly, visited one of Ruby's strip clubs. Also, in the late 1950s, FBI files, most provided to the Warren Commission, show that Ruby became involved in gunrunning to Cuba with several associates of Santo Traficante, among them gangsters Norman Rothman and Dominic Bartoni, as well as corrupt former Cuban president Carlos Prio. Los Angeles mobster Mickey Cohen was also running guns to Cuba at that time, and Ruby told one of his business partners he was a close friend of Mickey Cohen. The FBI documented numerous ties between Ruby and Cohen's girlfriend, a well-known burlesque dancer from Texas whose stage name was Candy Barr. Jack Ruby also knew Jimmy Hoffa, according to Hoffa's son. Much evidence and testimony shows that Ruby was involved in the same operations as Jack LaRue. Unbeknownst to Robert Kennedy in 1959, when he was fruitlessly looking for the mysterious Jack LaRue, Jack Ruby was running guns to Cuba with the associates of LaRue. Jack Ruby could have well been one of those using the LaRue alias. In 1959, Ruby's Cuban gun-running and arms deals with Castro's men made him an excellent candidate to be a courier-messenger between Ruby's boss Marcello and the detained Traficante. But Ruby had an even better cover for his activities because he'd recently become an informant for the FBI. In March of 1959, Ruby had been interviewed by the Bureau and asked to become an informant. Ruby, no doubt after checking with mob superiors in Dallas, such as Savello or Campisi, agreed. Such an arrangement could give him an extra degree of protection for his illegal activities and a way to find out what crimes the FBI was interested in. In 1959, Ruby reported to the FBI on at least 8 occasions, but according to historian Gerald D. McKnight, the Warren Commission hid that fact from the American public. It was not until 12 years after the Warren Report was published that the American people learned that Ruby had been an FBI informant. The fact that Ruby's tenure as an informant overlapped with his trip to Cuba to visit Traficante might explain why the Warren Commission refused to reveal Ruby's role as informant for the Bureau. Ruby met with his FBI handler on July 2, 1959, less than a month after Traficante was detained. Ruby met with the FBI again on July 21. Traficante originally had another messenger he could rely on, electronics expert John Martino. According to Vanity Fair, Martino said that his principal mission had been to liberate gambling cash left behind by Traficante. Those funds were essential for any attempt to buy Traficante's release from his Cuban detainment. But Martino was arrested in Cuba on July 23, 1959, after a flurry of trips between Miami and Cuba. Unlike Traficante, Martino was sent to a Cuban prison, serving 3 years in what he considered hellish conditions. Martino's absence made someone like Ruby even more important as a potential messenger courier. According to Scott Malone, congressional investigators found that those who wanted Trafficante released included Johnny Roselli and his boss, Sam Giancana, both of whom visited Trafficante in jail in 1959. Other accounts say that Carlos Marcello attempted to free Trafficante, so his underling Jack Ruby was apparently part of that effort. While Trafficante was in jail in Cuba, Jack Ruby attempted arms deals to help secure Trafficante's release, according to several accounts. Scott Malone found that congressional investigators noted in a briefing memorandum that in 1959 Jack Ruby traveled to Cuba and visited Santo Trafficante in jail. Other reports came from the British journalist John Wilson, mentioned earlier, who was briefly jailed by Castro, and who said that while in jail he knew a gambling gangster type named Santo, who, he said, was visited frequently by another American gangster type named Ruby. A close friend of both Roselli and Giancana, who testified before the Senate Intelligence Committee in the 1970s, says Roselli told him Ruby was hooked up with Trafficante in the rackets in Havana. Ruby had many associates in common with Trafficante, but the most likely person to have taken Ruby to see Trafficante was gambling supervisor Louis McWillie, whom Ruby described as high class. Even after the revolution, McWillie was one of many mobsters still operating in Cuba. While most people think that Fidel Castro shut all the mafia casinos when he took over, that's only partially true. For economic reasons, they were quickly reopened. Frank Fiorini, who later renamed himself Frank Sturgis, a Trafficante hoodlum who'd fought alongside Fidel, was made the liaison between the Cuban government and the mob bosses who still ran, even if they no longer owned, the casinos. The former mob casinos would remain open until the fall of 1961. Jack Ruby admitted frequently that Louis McWillie was his idol, someone he almost worshipped as the personification of mob power and high-level access that Ruby could only dream of. Many years later, when interviewed under oath by the House Select Committee on Assassinations, McWillie prevaricated when asked if Ruby had accompanied him on his visits to Trafficante in prison. McWillie said, "It's possible he could have. I don't recall it, but he could have. I don't know for sure. I went out there with someone, but I don't recall who it was. It may have been Ruby. I don't think so. He could have been." McWillie testified shortly after the murders of numerous Marcello and Trafficante associates and government witnesses, Giancana, Roselli, Hoffa, Nicoletti, and others. Since Marcello and Trafficante were still alive and in power when McWillie testified, and he was still working at casinos, his equivocation is as close to a, "Yes, Ruby went with me," as the committee could possibly expect. As Rolling Stone noted in a major investigative article, in August 1959, Ruby visited Havana at the invitation of Louis McWillie, the syndicate's manager at the Tropicana Casino, and a man Ruby said he idolized. A friend of Ruby's recently told House investigators that the former errand boy had been summoned to help arrange freedom for Santo Trafficante. Official U.S. and Cuban records show a confusing array of several trips by Ruby to Cuba in the late summer of 1959, with unexplained gaps in the travel records indicating that some of his entrances and exits were surreptitious. On August 6, 1959, Ruby met with his FBI handler again. 2 days later, on August 8, Ruby flew to Cuba from New Orleans, listing the Capri Hotel and Casino, mostly owned by Trafficante, as his destination. 10 days later, Trafficante was released from detention. Trafficante's attorney, Frank Regano, wrote that Trafficante told him he had met with Raul Castro, Fidel's brother. "We worked out an arrangement," he said cryptically. Regano said that most probably the meeting with Raul was decisive in getting him released, but that, nevertheless, there had to be a bribe at some point in the chain of events that led to his freedom. Ruby may well have helped with that bribe and or its aftermath, as his mysterious trips to Cuba continued into September. After his Cuba visits ended, Ruby ceased being an FBI informant on October 2, 1959. Ruby had one more unusual role to play in Cuba in early 1960. The Hoffa-brokered plots between the CIA and the Mafia to kill Fidel that began in 1959 and were continuing in the early months of 1960, though neither Traficante nor Ruby's boss Marcello had any documented role in those plots. However, former Cuban mob powerhouse Meyer Lansky had reportedly placed a $1 million bounty on killing Fidel Castro, since, unlike Traficante, Lansky had been unable to reach an accommodation with the Castro brothers. In January 1960, Tropicana casino manager Louis McWillie asked Jack Ruby to legally buy 4 Colt Cobra revolvers in Dallas and bring them to Havana. Jack Ruby was then the manager of 2 small Dallas nightclubs, including one he fronted for Carlos Marcello's organization. Because so much gun-running to Cuba had been going on, the Colt revolvers could have been easily obtained by a gangster like McWillie in Havana. Likewise, Ruby, a career criminal, could have easily obtained such weapons illegally in Dallas. But for some reason, McWillie needed these pistols to be easily traced back to a legal purchase in Dallas so that it was clear they weren't linked to organized crime or any illegal, or CIA, gun-running operation. On that occasion, Jack Ruby, for some reason, balked at McWillie's request to go to Cuba, even though he had visited Cuba several times the previous summer. After Ruby's refusal, the Tropicana's McWillie asked Ruby to ship the 4 pistols to him in Havana. Records and testimony are murky about what happened next and whether or not some of the guns were shipped to Cuba. What is known definitively is that Ruby purchased at least 1 Colt Cobra. Few journalists have asked if Jack Ruby was supplying the pistols to McWillie so they could be used in an assassination plot against Castro. Some evidence does indicate that the episode could have been part of the continuing plots to kill Fidel brokered by Hoffa between the CIA and the Mafia. Gangster Louis McWillie had been part of Ruby's Cuban venture with Hoffa associate Dominic Bartoni the previous year, and government files show that McWillie had solid Mafia connections to Meyer Lansky, who also wanted Castro killed. When Ruby bought the pistol for McWillie, Ruby was accompanied by an ex-boxer, possibly close Hoffa associate Barney Baker, described by Robert Kennedy as one of Jimmy Hoffa's roving emissaries of violence. Cuban authorities arrested a gangster and his associates for attempting to kill Fidel later in 1960, and among the weapons photographed was a pistol resembling the Colt Cobras McWillie pressed Ruby to buy. 1 Colt Cobra, definitely purchased by Jack Ruby in January 1960, would find greater infamy more than 3 years later. It was the pistol Ruby used to shoot accused assassin Lee Oswald on live television on November 24, 1963. Ruby's notorious gun, at the very least, came out of his involvement with the Mafia and possibly from the mob's early work with the CIA to kill Fidel. Another important factor in Ruby's character and in JFK's assassination, the Carousel Strip Club that Ruby managed in Dallas, across from the posh Adolphus Hotel, also began in 1960. New information, for the first time, shows that Carlos Marcello and his organization actually controlled the Carousel Club, not Jack Ruby. Ruby was only the club's manager, but the timing indicates that being allowed to manage the Carousel and to present himself as its owner might have been Marcello's reward to Ruby for his activities in Cuba with Traficante. Ruby ran a string of failed clubs before the Carousel, and for decades it was assumed by authorities and historians that Ruby had at least one investor, his good friend Ralph Paul, who kept lending Ruby huge sums of money for his money-losing ventures. Ruby also owed large sums to the IRS throughout the early 1960s, first approaching $20,000 and by 1963, $40,000. In today's dollars, that's $240,000. Yet the House Select Committee on Assassinations found that Paul repeatedly loaned Ruby money, which eventually may have totaled $15,000, plus an additional larger sum of money, allegedly $15,000 to $17,000, to assist Ruby with his taxes. In today's dollars, that's